Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Andrew McGowan. I'm with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I'm representing Mr. Leland Hall, the appellant in this case.
And I'm a broken record, but is he aware that... Because here's someone who was, you know, sentenced at the top of the guideline range. And, you know, again, is he willing to take the risk that Judge, I guess it was Judge Randa? I think it was. Yeah, it was Judge Randa. Might sentence him to even more.
Your Honor, he does not like the idea of possibly getting a more sentence, but I have discussed it with him at length, and especially considering the fact that we have another argument that should lower the range a bit, should this court decide with us, he wanted to continue with this appeal. And I understand the court's concern. In fact, I appreciate the court's concern. In this case, Mr. Hall appeals a sentencing enhancement as well as asking for a limited Paladino remand in the alternative. However, the district court in this case increased his felon in possession sentence based on a finding that he possessed the firearm in connection with another felony offense. And that other felony offense was a transaction that he had committed about 15 minutes before he was found with the gun to rent the car in which the gun was found. The district court, not knowing where the gun was, there's no evidence in the record to establish where the gun was or who had the gun at that time, indicated that it believed that the 15 minutes was sufficient to establish the in connection with requirement. And Mr. Hall appeals that decision. The government argues, without any case law, that temporal proximity, there's that word again, or phrase I should say, should provide sufficient support. However, temporal proximity doesn't work in this case for a couple of reasons, at least. One of which is it only establishes 10 to 15 minutes that within the range of a car there was a gun, even if you could establish that Mr. Hall possessed it 15 minutes before, which is not necessarily established by the record.
I don't understand. Where do you think the gun came from? I don't get that. You don't think it was Hall's gun?
Well, he was convicted of possessing it in the car. However, Mr. Hall's statements were various, and one of them included somebody else brought the gun with him to the car.
Well, who's going to believe that, for goodness sake?
Your Honor,
What's the point?
But the question is, the transaction for the car, we don't know where the car was either. I mean, we just don't know where that gun was. And temporal proximity.
Well, we don't know where the gun was. I don't get you.
There's no evidence in the record at all about where the gun was.
Well, there wasn't.
The gun was in the car.
It was in the car when he was found with it, but we're talking about 15 minutes before.
Well, where on earth do you think the gun was 15 minutes before?
If it was his gun, it was not in the car. He transacted for that car 15 minutes before.
Well, didn't the judge also find that Hall had been alone in the car because there was no melted snow anywhere except under his feet? How do you explain
that? There are findings that I'm not objecting to. However, it still doesn't establish where the gun was. We just don't know. It could have been in a...
You think for $17 he bought the car and the gun?
No, it was a $10 rock, but I don't think the gun came with the car for that rock, no.
So
I'm not
where did
arguing
the gun
that.
Come from?
That's what we don't know.
Well, I don't understand. It fell out of the sky or what? What's your theory of how the gun got there?
There were two plausible explanations, one of which was the client's explanation. Somebody else brought the gun in the car.
I don't find that plausible. He's walking
the
by and he flips the gun into the car or what?
Somebody else gets in the car with a gun? That happens all the time, Your Honor.
But that happens all the time? That's frightening thought. What, someone just leapt in his car with a gun, left the gun on the driver's seat and leapt out?
Well, I just don't know where the gun was, Your Honor. But, I mean, in terms of the finding that there was nobody else in the car because there was no snow, it is possible to go into heated parking garages, somebody getting in and out. I mean, it's possible to have somebody in the car without snow.
It's so unlikely.
Your Honor, that's the problem with not knowing where the gun was. This is exactly the problem. We just don't know where it was.
I don't understand you. I don't really understand you. It seems fantastic what you're arguing.
The other problem...
Do you think there's a contradiction in the fact that the judge found at... he declined to find that the gun was used in connection with operating a stolen vehicle?
Actually, I believe it was operating a car without the owner's permission. And the district court, obviously spent some time on that, ruled on it. I don't believe the government's pursuing that particular avenue. But, of course, in the situation where he rented the car for the $10 rock, I mean, it's a situation of whose car was it. In any event, I don't believe the government's pursuing that. The district court made an explicit finding. The other problem with the in connection, with not knowing where the gun is the in connection does require a little bit more than possession. Not a whole lot more, but a little bit more. So if you don't know where the gun is, it's hard to establish what the gun was there for. And the temporal proximity as opposed to physical proximity, we have a case that we both talk about in the brief where the defendant was in a closet with a gun. Now, the temporal proximity of that is about, 5 to 10 seconds away, depending on how hard it is to get to the top shelf in the closet. But in this case, the temporal proximity being not knowing where the gun is insufficient, we believe, to establish the four-point adjustment. I would like to preserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there are any questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. McCown. Mr. Kam.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Scott Campbell. I'm an assistant United States attorney with the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and I represent the United States in this appeal. I'd like to briefly address just the two issues that this appeal presents, the first of which is whether the district court clearly erred in finding that Mr. Hall possessed his handgun in connection with the crack for car deal that he admits went down only 50 minutes earlier. As the Court points out, the alternative scenario that Mr. Hall presents is certainly a fantastic one. It has no evidentiary support in the record. But even if it were something that were plausible, here the question really boils down to, was the district court choosing among permissible inferences? And I submit that the answer is a resounding yes. Just because Mr. Hall can present a different scenario under which he trades crack for the car, and then within the 15 minutes thereafter, before the police find him and arrest him, he got a gun from some other source, not only does that not have any support in the record, but the scenario that the court did accept certainly is a plausible one. And its choice among these competing plausible scenarios cannot in itself be plain error under this court's established jurisprudence. And certainly the scenario that the court did accept is a reasonable one. As the court points out, it's just common sense that if Mr. Hall is found with a gun by the police at 7 o'clock on that evening, and he admits that he traded crack for a car that he was found in only 15 minutes earlier, common sense suggests that he also had the gun 15 minutes beforehand. The odds are pretty slim that he got the gun in the interim. And even if he did get the gun in the interim, I submit that even under that scenario, that shows that at least he had access to the gun within a reasonable period around the time that he consummated the drug deal. So that gun could, even under that scenario that he offers, still provide an emboldening role to him. It could embolden him to engage in the drug transaction, and to that extent, the gun would facilitate the transaction. So Judge Randa's acceptance of this very common sense scenario.
I don't see how it would make him bolder to have the transaction first and then get the gun. I don't get that.
Well, at least, Judge, the gun is accessible to him. And I say that only because, for example, in the Wyatt case out of this court, there, Mr. Wyatt, his gun appeared not to have been moved in quite some time. The gun was found near where he kept papers about his marijuana dealings and near where he kept some of his baggies for trading marijuana and things. And there, the court pointed out that it may have been quite some time since Mr. Wyatt had used his guns, but at least their presence, the fact they were there to protect him, might embolden him to continue engaging in drug transactions. And to be sure here, Judge, I submit that the most plausible scenario is that Mr. Hall had this gun when he traded crack for the car, he puts the gun on the car and drives away. And Judge Randa's acceptance of that very reasonable hypothesis, even though Mr. Hall might offer a competing one, cannot render his decision to accept that reasonable hypothesis clear error. Unless the court has any further questions on this, I'd like to proceed to the perhaps more interesting Palladino issue. So I'll go there now. Plainly, the easiest way to figure out what Judge Randa would have done had he known that the guidelines were merely advisory as opposed to mandatory is to ask him.
But did he state anything at sentence?
Well,
sentencing that would lead us to believe, you know, that he felt constrained by the guidelines?
No, he said nothing to the contrary. And in fact, he said some things that would give this court a lot of comfort, that the sentence he imposed is at least the sentence he would impose had he known that the guidelines were merely advisory. Specifically, Judge, he spent about 3 pages of the sentencing transcript, I think they're pages 102 through 104, addressing the very 3553A factors that now, in essence, drive the train when it comes to sentencing. So the judge did, of course, calculate the guideline score, we argue correctly. But then even after doing that, he proceeded to discuss the character of Mr. Hall, the gravity of his offense, and the need to protect, you know, social factors, the need to protect society. And he said that after analyzing all those factors and spending about 2 pages of the transcript detailing Mr. Hall's criminal history, that really the emphasis here has to come down on deterrence and protecting society, and then he proceeded to impose a 78-month top-of-the-guideline sentence. I submit, Judge, that the fact that the judge carefully addressed the 3553A factors, combined with the fact that he imposed a sentence at the top of the guidelines range, can give this court every confidence that even if Judge Randa had known that the guidelines were merely advisory, he would have imposed at least the same sentence. You know, when a judge does impose a sentence at the top of the guideline, it suggests that he felt constrained much more by the top of the guideline than any concern about the bottom of the guideline.
Well, we don't know what's in his mind, do we?
No, we don't. And to be sure, the safest course is to do a Palladino remand here. But this court did recognize in Lee that where a judge does impose a sentence at the top of the guideline range, that can be anyway, under the appropriate circumstances, persuasive evidence that, this is my gloss on the dicta in Lee now, but at least Lee leaves open the possibility that a top of a guidelines range sentence does suggest that the judge would have imposed the same sentence or might have imposed the same sentence had he recognized that the guidelines range was merely advisory and not mandatory. Unless there are any further questions, we'll rest in our brief for the further.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you.
McGowan? Okay. Well, thank you very much to both counsel. And you were appointed. Well, you're, you know, the defender, so we thank you for your efforts on behalf.
Thank you.
Next case for argument, Wall versus City of Brookfield, Mr. Ertl.